I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz is here to take your questions. We'll talk about the redevelopment of Sparrows Point and what kinds of jobs might materialize there, the repeal of the rain tax and what impact that will have on other items in the budget, and Kamenetz's disputes with Republican Governor Hogan and with Democratic Controller Francho over money for schools. We'll get his thoughts about public housing, how the region is recovering from the riot and protests in April, and what role county residents should play in that recovery. All that and your questions for County Executive Kamenetz on Midday after news headlines from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Very glad that you've joined us today. Kevin Kamenetz, County Executive of Baltimore County since 2010, is here. He's in the middle of a lot of issues, from school air conditioning to police body cameras to affordable housing to public transportation. We asked him here today to give us an update on some of these issues and to get his views on the Baltimore metropolitan region. What are your questions for Kevin Kamenetz? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can call us locally. 410-662-8780 is our number. And we also have a toll-free line, if that works out better for you, 866-661-9309. That's the toll-free line. Kevin Kamenetz is in his second term as Baltimore County Executive. He served 16 years before that on the County Council, representing North and Northwest Baltimore County. He is a lawyer and worked 5 years in the 80s as an assistant prosecutor in Baltimore City. I hadn't known that. Well, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks, Sheila. Good to be here.
So let's start with an issue that the Baltimore Sun gave a lot of attention to yesterday. Investigative reporter Doug Donovan wrote a lengthy piece about public housing, specifically a court-ordered relocation program that has moved about 3,000 public housing residents from Baltimore City to better neighborhoods, often in surrounding counties. The piece, as you know, is not targeted directly on Baltimore County, but it paints a picture of a county that over the years has resisted public housing. And specifically, it quoted former State Attorney General Steve Sachs, quote, he said, quote, "There is a noose around Baltimore City, and as a consequence, we have economic apartheid," Sachs said. Quote, "In terms of education, jobs, transportation, housing, you name it, it's been that way for decades. The counties do nothing to accommodate the poor, and nothing changes," close quote. What was your reaction reading that?
Well, first of all, I thought the article was very well written and very fair. I think Attorney General Sachs is probably talking about a scenario of decades ago when he says that, however, because Baltimore County has changed significantly in the last 10 years. We are much more diverse population, 35% non-white, increasing numbers of poor people, homeless people. We talk about taking care of residents. We just opened last June a $6.5 million men's homeless facility, a shelter in Catonsville that replaced trailers. And last month we broke ground on a $24 million transitional housing center on the grounds of Franklin Square Hospital that will provide not only homeless services but also housing for women and children, and allow them to stay there and transition for weeks at a time until they can secure permanent housing. And in addition, we have all the wraparound services, mental health, vocational counseling, and so forth. Over the years, we've done a pretty good job at finding housing, encouraging projects for low-income seniors, and also to promote home buyership, home ownership, for middle and low income home buyers. And now we're starting to focus quite appropriately on trying to find better rental housing opportunities for low income individuals as well as the disabled. So it's a slow effort. because a lot of the reasons that we have the disparities are due to non-intentional concepts.
Explain that.
Sure. Baltimore County, 50 years ago, created the urban-rural demarcation line, in which two-thirds of our county geographically is rural, has some of the most conservative zoning in the country, one house every 50 acres, and is on well and septic and not public water and sewer, and there are no public transportation in those areas. So by its nature, with the farms and minimum acre lot sizes that preserve the environmental features, that's not an area where you're going to have multifamily dwelling. And we're a mature county. We were kind of built out in the 60s and mm-hmm. 70s, and as a result, there aren't large land masses available that could support new housing projects to a significant degree. But that being said, we're committed to identifying additional opportunities. And we want to place them in areas where there's not already, we don't want to have a concentration of poverty or a reconcentration of poverty. So it's challenging to try and find locations that will work zoning-wise and also aren't already in impacted areas. But, we're focusing on it, and I think we're making a lot of progress.
One of the points that Doug Donovan specifically wrote about in his piece in The Sun is that most counties have not taken two steps encouraged by housing advocates. One you addressed, requiring developers to set aside housing for low-income tenants. And secondly, prohibiting landlords from refusing to accept tenants with federal rent subsidies, housing vouchers.
That's the source of income legislation that was proposed and has failed several times in the state, although there are counties that have it. Montgomery has it, Frederick has it, even Howard has it to a modified degree. That's something that we're going to look at in Baltimore County. And basically it says that a landlord has to include a voucher as a source of income for the person. They can't disqualify based on a lack of income.
Right. So you're going to look at it. That's far short of a commitment to support it.
Well, it's a process, and we have to work to get the council to see, the why I think it would make sense. But right now we're in negotiations with HUD, and we're talking about a lot of different things. So rather than, and we're kind of pretty close to wrapping this up, so I'm not going to make any public statements at this time as to what direction we actually are going in until we finalize our negotiations with HUD.
But you say they're close to wrapping up. What can you give us some kind of a timeline? When should I ask you back to talk about about the negotiations?
When HUD announces that a settlement has been reached,
and that will be
that's up to HUD, I guess.
That's Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz here on Midday on WYPR, and I'm Sheila Kasten. You can be part of the conversation. What are your questions for County Executive Kamenetz? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us locally, 410-662-8780.
You're being a good reporter there, Sheila. That was good, though.
Well, thank you, I guess. After the riot and the protests in Baltimore City in April, you were very vocal about how Baltimore County's success is linked to the health of the city. What are you looking for in Baltimore's next mayor?
Great question. First of all, I don't call them the riots, because I remember 1968 and those were riots. So I call it unrest, and it was. And
you will probably get a caller who will want to dispute that.
Well, I say that because that being said, it was a very helpful thought process for my staff, because we had great conversations about what role the county should be playing in the region. And, we'd already been going through the motions of these conversations with the HUD aspect, but it really got into what we need to do as a region to help the city as well. As to the next mayor, I think it's we need someone who understands neighborhoods and how to build up particular neighborhoods, and how to grow the city neighborhood by neighborhood. So there's some very vibrant areas that are doing extremely well. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, the harbor, but then Harbor East was created. But then you get into, and we knew about Fells Point, but then you get into Canton. And, you know, Canton took off. And then Federal Hill, we always knew about. But now you've got Locust Point. Who would have thought that Locust Point would have been this hot spot to live in for a millennial? But it's amazing what's happened. So all of that is very exciting. But I think the idea, also just when I was driving up here, watching North and Charles evolve, mm-hmm. That was really exciting and around the train station. So the question is, how do you use these different spots to then link the certain neighborhoods? You know, if you can kind of link, you know, North Avenue and figure out how to branch off both east and west and kind of spread some of that excitement, I think is a good thing. But you have to do it neighborhood by neighborhood, and you can't, you really have to be linked to an existing neighborhood and build off of there to grow it. A mayor, you know, the next mayor, I hope, has a good sense of how to get those things done strategically. Also, continue to support the economic growth of the city. Number one priority is schools, quite frankly, because you want to keep these millennials here. And when they get married and then they have kids, that's when they're making decisions about, do I stay in the city? And in order to build the city, you have to have a mature growth. And if the school system doesn't have the strongest reputation, then parents will start looking out in other jurisdictions. The crime situation, I think, is certainly manageable, and it really, I think body cameras are really going to be helpful. I mean, we're going to do it in Baltimore County, too, where we probably have a, you know, where I think we have a pretty good relationship between the police and the community. But, you know, I know that we are just one bad decision by a police officer away from having that distrust. So that's why I think cameras are really going to be helpful, and especially in the city.
Let me ask you for an update on that. In September, you and County Police Chief Jim Johnson announced plans to equip all police precincts with body cameras by this coming July?
Yes, July 1, the beginning of the fiscal year.
So all police officers in Baltimore County, or just every precinct?
No. We will be phasing them in with police officers, but there will be police officers in every precinct who have cameras. So I think we have a 2-year phase in where until all police officers will have them.
And are there questions that need to be? I mean, are you doing a test? Are you trying out different brands of cameras? Or
well,
last
September when we announced it in July, we will have picked the vendor and the type of equipment to use and the training protocol, and a lot of that is also dependent upon this General Assembly session, depending on what the state legislature decides on what restrictions there are, or controls. I want you to, I think the best thing about cameras is that it will improve the behavior of both police officers and the citizens. I think
that's what they say in Laurel, which has had police cameras for a while. That seems to be the hope on both sides.
It's a no-brainer to me. And you indicated I was a former prosecutor. I can tell you that cameras will result in speedier justice because in the criminal prosecution of cases, because you know you have a jurisdiction like the city where I think jurors tend to give less weight to the testimony of a police officer and requires more evidence to prove a case, and I think once you have a tape of you know, you don't get into this he said she said so much, the recording can really offer or tip that balance.
You have been very vocal about encouraging county residents to get out and visit the city. Do you think county residents were staying away from the city after the spring?
Yeah, unfortunately. And I would ask the cultural institutions, and these are regional cultural institutions that are located in the city, but the Baltimore County are large contributors. We give $3 million a year to the various institutions. And there are, I think last year, 687,000 county residents attended the Walters and the BMA and the zoo and the aquarium and the hippodrome and the Everyman Theater and Center Stage and, you know, the BSO. In fact, in all of those institutions, county residents comprise the largest percentage of the attendees based by jurisdiction. So in my conversation since April with the with these institutions, they told me that attendance is down, that they're hurting. And I talked to county residents, and even the restaurant owners downtown would tell me this. Mm-hmm. I talked to county residents, and you know, I said, "Well, you under," and I'm getting back to my theory here that the 68 were the real riots. I said, "It's not the April. Is it the April unrest? I mean, you know, that was really just centralized at Pennsylvania Avenue and North." And they said, "No, they're scared of the murder rate. That's what's scaring people from coming into the city, even though
the violent shooting.
It's pretty localized. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not people get, you know, it's not average residents by and large who are becoming victimized, but it's a fear factor. And I thought, you know, we really need to have leadership here to say, come on, everyone. We're all in this together. We are one region.
We are going to take a short break here. Later in the show, we hope to talk to the WIPR reporter covering the William Porter trial, the first of the Freddie Gray trials. But when we come right back, we will still be with Kevin Kamenetz. We have lots of questions for him, and you may very well have questions for him, too. You can ask them if you call us at 410-662-8780, or if you send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in a bit with County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, and here in the studio with Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. And you can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You can call us at 410-662-8780. This month, your county council in Baltimore County voted for mixed zoning at the site of the former Sparrows Point steel mill. There's already zoning for heavy industrial use. Now they've permitted light industrial and commercial and retail uses. What's the big picture at Sparrows Point? What are we going to see rise up there?
Well, I had the misfortune to inherit the closing of Bethlehem Steel, or the steel making as we know it, for over a century came to a close. And when Bethlehem Steel, at its heyday in the 50s, was employing 25,000-30,000 people in direct jobs, and then there was indirect jobs as well. But when RG Steel closed, it was just 2,000 jobs. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to be very thoughtful about what you could use this, what could be the future there that would be the next generation of jobs. And I recognize that while steelmaking probably does not have a future there, it doesn't, the land was something very special, the asset. It's 3,000 acres of land that's already zoned industrial in nature, that has deep water port access and access to two interstate highways and two rail lines. And I thought, well, gee, the Port of Baltimore is the economic engine of the state right now, and this would be a logical expansion opportunity to have port-related activities, logistics, distribution. So we painted a vision. We did a study, painted a vision, and we needed a buyer, a landowner who bought into that, and we now have that partner in place with Sparrows Point Terminal, and they share our vision of what we think could take place there. And I'm pretty confident that within the next 10 years, while we're not going to get to that 25,000 jobs, we should see about 10,000 good-paying jobs there, and perhaps even 10,000 temporary construction jobs in the interim. So part of Sparrows Point Terminal's vision is to build a complex or an industrial park that has other amenities to it. I think they want some retail opportunity. And they're very thoughtful in terms of, you know, structuring the parcel and identifying what can go where and get the highest and best use out of it. So we supported the legislation that was allows some non-industrial uses there, but it's just a small portion of the 3,000 acres.
The kinds of jobs that are going to come to Sparrows Point are not going to be the kinds of jobs that were there.
Well, they're not going to be
obviously
as dirty,
not steel making jobs, right. But I mean, are they going to be jobs, you know, that working class people can get?
Absolutely. I mean, I want you to think about distribution warehouses, and I know they're very close to signing a particular tenant that relate to the port. Though, think of, you know, when you import, you need to store and then distribute later. And if you can do it as close to the ship as possible, you save trucking costs and you expedite the process. But you can also have light assembly there, assemble and then export, or import and then assemble and then distribute. So there are many types of companies that want to take advantage of the asset of that land. And its proximity to interstate highways and to two rail lines. And all of those involve decent paying jobs, not minimum wage.
The companies that you or Sparrows Point Terminal, the partnership, are trying to entice to come to Sparrows Point, do they have the same concern that you just described many county residents having about crime in Center Baltimore? Is this dissuading businesses from looking at?
No. I think anyone who wants to locate there is doing it because of that. They're attracted by the location of Sparrows Point and the asset that it holds there. I don't think anyone, hopefully no one, is dissuaded by, you know, what has just taken place in the city. This is big picture stuff, and I think people want to locate here. That they're going to attract people from all over the East Coast.
One other question. After a century of steelmaking, there's a lot of embedded pollution in the site. Is it clear how that gets cleaned up and who pays for it?
Yes. Sparrows Point Terminal has the obligation of a cleanup. It's actually a lot cleaner than anyone anticipated. The largest area of contamination is on Coke Point, which is closest to the waterfront. But that remediation has to be fulfilled by Sparrows Point Terminal before they can make use of that land there. So they have an economic incentive as well.
That's Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz here on Midday on WYPR 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about all kinds of things. One thing I wanted to bring up, because we have a query that relates to it. Last month, the county council voted unanimously to phase out the county's stormwater remediation fee, commonly called the rain tax. The council voted to reduce the fees attached to 2016 property bills and to eliminate them after that. Has Baltimore County started targeting where they're going to find the $16 million annually in the budget to pay for federally mandated stormwater remediation projects if that revenue source is gone? And why are you laughing as I ask you? This is a serious question.
I'm not laughing. I'm just we started looking the second the council did this, because obviously it's a lot of money. Let me just give that quick recap of what happened here. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation sued the federal EPA for violating the 1972 Clean Water Act, and the EPA brought the state of Maryland in, and the consent decree was entered into, where they agreed that the state would begin aggressively targeting total daily maximum loads, which is a measurement of pollutants that enter into the Chesapeake Bay. And we are going to go on a pollution diet, so to speak. And then the state then told the largest jurisdictions, you now have this obligation. And we said, well, this should be a state obligation. And the state said, no, just you all pay for it. How are we supposed to pay for it? They said, we'll raise taxes. We said, well, we don't want to raise taxes. So they passed the stormwater remediation fee, which required us to pass a tax, and that would create a dedicated fund for stormwater. Well, Governor Hogan ran and made this big issue of it. It was, you know, these are good things, okay, what we're talking about doing. And when I go to community groups, I say, how many people here want to see streams rebuilt, stream beds rebuilt, or how many people want us to plant more trees, or how many people want us to have street sweepers? You know, these are all the kind of projects that we're trying to do that ultimately clean the result in a cleaner Chesapeake Bay. But you know, the governor campaigned and derided it as the rain tax. You know, I think people in Maryland are in favor of a cleaner environment, and they know that our economy relies on the Chesapeake Bay. So the bottom line is, you know, that fever now has reached Baltimore County, or at least the county council, so to speak, and the council eliminated it, but it doesn't eliminate our obligation. We still have to meet this commitment. So frankly, it means that we will have $24 million less annually to do other projects.
I used a number of $16 million. That's too low. It's actually $24 million
well,
the county
here's
needs
what
to spend
happened.
On these projects.
We actually reduced it by a third last March in respect to the voters' concerns about it, meaning we already are taking an additional $8 million out of our budget to do it, and now the council eliminated the remaining $16 million.
So... Well, I wanted to ask you about that because we have a query from David in Baltimore County who emailed us. Mr. County Executive, why can't you use the $20+ million you're getting for ambulance service to pay for the rain tax and or air conditioning county schools? Something I haven't asked you about yet, but hope to. So why can't you use ambulance money?
We are starting. We haven't yet collected any fees yet on that. But with Obamacare, where there will be a mandate for everyone to have insurance, we decided that we would now charge the insurance companies a fee for our medic service, and that will raise money. We don't know how much yet, because it depends how much we collect from the insurance companies. But yeah, that's clearly going to be a source. But, you know, frankly, we were looking for that money to pay for school construction. So this is part of our challenge.
We've got some other callers. Martha from Landau.
Yes.
Welcome to Midday.
Yes, thank you.
Your question for County Executive Kamenetz?
Okay. About a half year ago, we asked the county what had happened to the streetlight on our block. Things went back and forth. It is now December. This started, I think, in the spring. Just last week, first of all, we were told that the county had to vote on a contract or something like that so that BG&E would put the streetlight out because no one would take responsibility. There was a streetlight there before. The lines had been cut. Last week they said they were lying the cable. Today I saw there was a cherry picker, but they said that they needed yet another crew to put up the street lamp. And when I called the county, I was actually told something to the effect of, lady, do you realize that not everybody in the county has a street light? Well, in my area, we have sidewalk street lights. It's rather densely populated.
Okay. Let me just get clear. You're talking about a particular street light that's exactly where?
It's right off 7 Mile and Smith.
Okay. Is this something that you're up to speed on, County Executive Kamenetz?
I'm not aware of the particular issue, but Martha, just do me a favor. Just call my office, 410-887-2450, and ask someone to look into the issue, okay? And we'll see what we can find out. But it is a BGE obligation. They're the ones who service those lights, not the county. But we'll be happy to look into it if you give my office a call.
Thank you for calling, Martha. Terry in Towson. What's your question for Connie?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in a neighborhood just outside the core of Towson. And as you know, Towson's rapidly changing with development, increase in traffic, noise pollution, and we're crying out for more green space. And a spot's become available. I believe the name's Radabaugh Park. And there was an announcement in the Towson Times that you were all for it, that it was moving ahead. And I understand it's stalled now. So I wanted to address what's going on with Radabaugh Park and also finding more green space for the residents of Towson.
Thank you. Radabaugh is it's basically a square that is surrounded by some houses, and we think it would have been a nice spot for some open space, probably passive open space. It's not that large, but the negotiations have broken down with the property owner, so we're still in the midst of that. And the problem is there's additional costs associated with demolition of the structures that we had not budgeted. So if we can work those out, we're going to go ahead with that. But I think what would be more exciting would be to have this two-acre park at Patriot Plaza, which is between the two courthouses. That really would be exciting. We have a vision there that would turn impervious surface into pervious and have a lot of good green space and park space. And this is basically the courthouse. It's between the historic courthouse and the circuit court. The council deferred a vote on this last week, and I would certainly encourage you to contact your council member, which would be Councilman Marks, and the rest of the council to please go ahead and approve this contract so we can go ahead with that.
Terry, thanks for the query. I want to get back to the air conditioning of the schools. You and Controller Peter Francho have been sparring over how to get that done. You want to renovate the schools that need it. Francho just wants to get box air conditioners, window units, into the classrooms that need them. Peter Francho's called for a legislative public meeting on the matter in order to change current rules and allow state school construction money to be used for portable units. If this happened, would you be allowed to use state funds to solve the lack of air conditioning? Would you be willing to go with portable units?
Well, let's look at the big picture here. When I took office 5 years ago, 80% of our schools were more than 40 years old, and just 48% of our schools were air conditioned. It's not just air conditioning, it's not just the age of the schools, it's also we're overcrowded. We have a rising enrollment. So I embarked on a comprehensive plan, a $1.3 billion Schools for Our Future plan, will eliminate all current and projected overcrowding, modernize our schools, adding Wi-Fi technology and public safety improvements, as well as air condition all the remaining schools. And as of this current fiscal year, that number of air conditioned schools has risen from 48% to 85% funding in place. And we intend to get the job done in the next 3 years. The controller, for whatever reason, keeps focusing on room air conditioning. We think that's a temporary solution, and so does the State Interagency Committee on School Construction. They did a study that said that temporary room air conditioning is not the proper way to go. It's noisy. It's energy inefficient. It requires higher level of maintenance, which detracts from other maintenance tasks. It becomes unsightly. And more importantly, it takes dollars away from the pot that you would otherwise use for the permanent fix. So the controller's upset with that idea and now has demanded that the IAC change their policy. Well, it doesn't change the facts. All those facts are still out there. We agree with the IAC policy that for all of those reasons, temporary air conditioners are not the way to go. The controller said, well, you can just go to Home Depot and rent a U-Haul and load up on room air conditioners. And it's kind of silly because I talked about the age of our schools, and the remaining 15% are the ones that are most expensive because they're the oldest schools. They don't have the electrical wiring to handle room air conditioners. And again, it's not just room air conditioners we're doing. We're talking about central air, but also modernizing the schools.
Okay, that's Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz here on Midday. We're going to take another short break. When we return, we've got more questions for him and your questions also. You can send us more questions, midday@wypr.org, or give us a call, 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast, here with Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast here with Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz, talking about all kinds of issues in the county, including your questions. We got an email from Rose Marie, who asks Kevin Kamenetz, what are the current plans for Rosewood Hospital land? This is what, about 140 acres that used to be the Rosewood Center in Owings Mills, the Institution for the Developmentally Disabled. And Stevenson University wants to buy the land, right?
Yes. We did a task force, I want to say 6 or 7 years ago, when the state talked about closing Rosewood and what to do with the land. And this is the parcel that's between Reisterstown Road and Garrison Forest Road. Stevenson University is the party that has stepped forward and said that they would like to purchase or acquire the land from the state, and the county is supportive of that request. It's bogged down only because there are negotiations going on between Stevenson and the state about the environmental cleanup that's required there. Apparently, these buildings are old and have asbestos, and there are other underground pipes and other issues there. So if they can ever resolve that purchase price and who bears the cost of the cleanup, I think this would complement Stevenson University's campus goal, which is to have more athletic fields as well as using some of the existing buildings for classroom space.
Another school question. School Superintendent Dallas Dance's contract ends in June, and he said he'd like to stay on for another 4 years. He's asked for the school board to take a vote. You have been very supportive of him, although you don't have a say in whether he gets another contract. Are you concerned that Governor Hogan's appointment of Ann Miller, a conservative blogger, will put Superintendent Dance's contract in jeopardy?
Well, let me tell you, Superintendent Dallas Dance has been doing a great job. He's dynamic. He and I have been great partners. We share the same vision for our school system, putting electronic devices in the hands of children, requiring children to be proficient in a second language. These are important goals to educate children in today's 21st century environment. The superintendent is nationally renowned. I'm certain that he would be grabbed up by any other jurisdiction immediately. I think Montgomery County hasn't hired anyone yet for their vacancy because they're trying to see what Baltimore County might do. When I go into a school, though, that's when I see the real difference here, because these children go flocking toward Dr. Dance. They admire him. They know him. They respect him. They like him. I hope our school board recognizes the great progress that has been made in the last several years under Dr. Dance's leadership. Obviously I am concerned about Governor Hogan's appointments only because he hasn't consulted me whatsoever or taken my advice maybe or recommendations regarding appointments. And I am concerned about the future of the school board. I will tell you that when Governor O'Malley was in office, he consulted with me regularly and took the advice. So obviously, I'm disappointed that Governor Hogan hasn't. But I would also hope that he respects the needs of our school system. Ann Miller is a Republican Party activist. She's written articles that are against Common Core, against transgender rights. She wrote against the DREAM Act. She homeschools one of her children. It doesn't sound to me like she has confidence in our school system, and I'm not sure, or believes in our school system. So I'm not sure whether You know, we have to, our school system has to represent all children that attend our schools, and we have to be inclusive.
You have quite a few running arguments going with Governor Hogan, it seems to me. One, when he announced this month that he would include new education funding for Kent, Garrett, and Carroll counties in Western Maryland, you called that turning his back on the big urban counties. How do you see that working out? I mean, he has refused to fund.
It's 68. Yeah, I mean, $68 million of GCEI funding.
The geographical
cost of education index, and the General Assembly found the money, and he chose to just keep it sitting on the shelf, so to speak. He can't spend it on anything else, this is money that would be used by each of the counties in important ways. For example, 3.7% of Baltimore County school students do not speak English. And those schools have that additional challenge of trying to help these students learn English and be productive students. That's money we would have used for additional teacher aides and also parental counseling to try and integrate those students. We all have rising enrollments, so the governor refuses to give out this money on his own principle. And now suddenly says, okay, to Carroll County, you have declining enrollment. We'll give you an extra $4 million to help you wean yourself off of the budget. I didn't quite understand the logic of it. It seemed like he was trying to favor these jurisdictions of declining enrollment for politics as opposed to fiscal prudence. Specifically in Carroll County, they are losing such enrollment that they have to close three schools next year. And that's a really difficult process because communities get upset, and rightfully so. So they're going through that painstaking process. And then the governor says, well, here's $4.4 million. You can delay or defer that decision for a year. Well, why? That's just kicking the can down the road. And it doesn't encourage Carroll County school system to be fiscally prudent.
Another issue in which you're locking horns with Governor Hogan, the high-frequency bus plan he proposed for the Baltimore region after he canceled the light rail project, the Red Line. You say that is simply window dressing. A bus system is not a mass transportation solution. What would be a mass transportation solution?
Well, look, the governor in his prerogative had the right to cancel the Red Line, but what I faulted him on was not having a plan B. And then he took the money that was allocated toward Baltimore Region Mass Transit and dispersed it to what I think are dubious rural road projects. And that doesn't help us. Straightening a road out in Garrett County that has one car every 30 seconds perhaps traveling it doesn't go as far for the same dollar that it would if it were invested in mass transit here. What we need is a regional mass transit system that's integrated. We now have the metro, the hard rail, and we have the light rail, and both of those have terminuses in Baltimore County. But we need more of a system. And the idea is not to just improve a bus system, which his transportation secretary said that Baltimore's just a bus town, whatever that meant. The bus system needs to be improved, of course. I think that's a proper goal. But we need more than that. You need to attract the choice rider. So the person who's riding on the Baltimore Beltway who has a choice as to whether they use transit or not, public transit. That's not the bus. That should be a modern system that encourages that option for that person, makes it viable for them.
We have a call from Stephen in Baltimore that relates to transportation. I think, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
When me and my daughters are at the major intersections in Baltimore County, we always have fun counting all of the cameras that are on the signs as well as on the above the lights. We've gotten as high as 10 at certain intersections. Some of them are facing, obviously, looks like the cockpit of the car or the back of the car. The car pulls away. And I've always wondered, what's the rules on collecting that information, and where can I find the rules on the Baltimore County website?
Well, thanks, Stephen. Let me clarify that. They're not cameras in that sense. They are car detectors that are used to activate the traffic signal. So the old method would be to have a wire loop in the concrete or the asphalt that would be like a metal detector that would determine that a car was waiting for a light signal to change. And we changed about 8 years ago, to these little cameras that actually are just looking to see, is there a car in that lane? And if the car is there, then it activates the signal. But there's no data being collected on there.
Thank you for the call, Stephen. I'm getting updated on the trial of Officer William Porter that the prosecution and defense have given their closing arguments. There's a brief break right now before the prosecution makes its rebuttal. I think we are not going to be able to pull WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns out of the trial coverage to get an update, but he certainly will have an update tonight during All Things Considered. So if you're following the trial, you'll want to stay tuned for that. Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz, I think people listening to our conversation, some of your criticisms of Governor Hogan, some of your ongoing debates, shall we say, with Democratic controller Peter Francho, who is widely expected to run for governor, would listen to this and say, is Kevin Kamenetz getting ready to run for governor?
Well, it's not me arguing with them or debating, but it sure seems like they might be thinking that the way they keep focusing on me. Frankly, I'm working hard to promote my jurisdiction that I lead, 830,000 residents, but I'm also here to promote the interests of the Baltimore region because it's so vital to the future of this state. And then, of course, I'm interested in good government, not only locally, but on the state level. I've got 3 years left on my contract, and I'm gonna work till the very last day.
Well,
as hard as I can.
I hope you'll come back and talk with us often during those 3 years. Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Always happy to be here. It's good to be here with you as well, Sheila.
Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. And thanks also to you for listening and participating in this show. And thanks to the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. It's located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. The Diz features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and crab cakes. It's open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends on the web at TheDizBaltimore.com. Tomorrow in Midday, we'll discuss a story about urban development and community investment and what happens when two plans to improve the city compete with each other. Hope you'll tune in for that. And right now, stay tuned for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Dronberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.